Well, good morning, and thank you to RFI for the opportunity to speak to you today. Property markets and financial stability are both topics that are dear to my heart, and I hope to yours as well. It's been known for generations that boom-bust cycles in asset prices can be harmful to the economy and to the people in it. They're especially harmful when fuelled by easy credit. Sadly, that knowledge hasn't stopped those busts occurring. The source of the threat to financial stability is actually more often in commercial property or property development rather than in home mortgages. So I think we need to keep the risks posed by housing and home mortgages in perspective. Still, if something did go badly wrong in the housing market, it would be painful and it would damage financial stability. So today I therefore want to go through some of the reasons why households might default on their mortgages, explain why the US market became so distressed, and show how we can continue to avoid a similar situation. Although this talk is about home mortgages, I want to emphasise that home mortgage markets with prudent lending standards do not generally pose risks to financial stability. It's not unusual for housing prices to fall, especially if they'd been booming previously, or if the economy had turned down. But for that to translate into a big upswing in mortgage defaults, the economy generally has to have weakened first. That was the pattern of the housing busts of the 1930s and early 1990s in many countries. It's also what we see in Ireland and Spain and the United Kingdom today. In those countries, as in the past, commercial real estate and property development have been the bigger problems. The recent cycle in commercial property prices has been at least as large as that in housing prices for essentially every country for which we have good data, including the United States, as well as countries like Spain and Ireland. Typically, the rate of home mortgage defaults remains low enough that it does not damage the financial system as much as property-related corporate loan defaults. The effects, therefore, do not feed back into the real economy to the same extent. All the same, the recent US experience shows that painful housing busts can happen. We'd certainly want to avoid one here. Housing lending is a larger fraction of the balance sheets of Australian banking institutions than for their US counterparts. So in the unlikely event a US-style bust did happen, it would be harmful to financial stability in Australia. So we should seek to avoid a US-style housing bust, not only because they harm financial stability, but also because they impose great social costs. Losing money in a failed property investment is one thing, but how much worse would it be to lose your home? Millions of American households have lost their homes to foreclosure. Whole neighbourhoods have been blighted by empty and even uninhabitable homes. Communities are fractured and lives are disrupted, sometimes permanently. There is no reason why Australia should follow the same path as the United States, but it's important that we continue to avoid the same mistakes. By we, I do not refer only to policymakers. Mortgage lenders need to refrain from easing lending standards the way they did in the United States. And so far, you have been refraining. It's a key difference between the two countries, and it motivates the title of my talk today: Prudent Mortgage Lending Standards Help Ensure Financial Stability. So why do some households default on their mortgages? There's a common misconception that US home buyers can just walk away from their mortgage and will do so whenever the value of their home falls below the loan balance. Non-recourse lending applies in some states for some borrowers, but not all borrowers. But the law in most US states, the vast majority of states, allows lenders to sue for any remaining shortfall from the proceeds of sale of foreclosed homes. It's just that many do not bother going to court to obtain a deficiency judgment, as they're known. Experience has shown that households are much less likely to default on their mortgages than a simple financial test would imply. Rather than just giving up and walking away at the first sign of difficulty, many borrowers strive to maintain their repayments or to get back on track after falling behind. So instead of imagining a ruthless defaulter who walks away from their first financial obligations, we need to focus more on capacity to pay and how it can decline. The reality is that things can happen to people that make it difficult to repay their loans. Bad things. Their relationships break down, or they lose their jobs, or a member of the family becomes too ill to work or even dies. We economists and credit risk modellers speak euphemistically of idiosyncratic risk, but this is what we mean. Financial stability policymakers cannot legislate away these individual setbacks and tragedies, but we can be alert to circumstances that could make them more common or more damaging. The most obvious factor that can make things worse is, of course, a recession. In good times, the people most at risk of losing their jobs are less likely than average to have a mortgage. As unemployment rises, though, many more people face a loss of income, and more of them are likely to have mortgages already. So the really large upswings in mortgage arrears have, perhaps not surprisingly, tended to occur at the same time as large increases in unemployment. And as you can see in the graph, this is certainly the experience in countries like the United Kingdom and Spain in recent years, as well as in their previous cycles in the early 1990s. Falling housing prices are another factor that tends to result in higher rates of mortgage arrears. If something bad happens to you and you can no longer afford your repayments, it is better to sell and have a bit left over after discharging the mortgage. But if the property value has fallen below the loan balance, you're in a much worse situation. You can't easily sell if you're in trouble, or even if you just want to move to a cheaper area or a more appropriate home or just to where the jobs are. So we need to be alert to falling house prices, but we also need to keep them in perspective. There still needs to be an underlying problem with the borrower's ability to repay before they default. A note of caution, though. Housing price growth is no longer running ahead of income growth the way it did during the 1990s and early 2000s, when the economy was still adjusting to disinflation and deregulation. And because inflation, and thus income growth, are now lower than in the 1970s and 1980s, soft periods in the housing market could now be more likely to involve falling housing prices. Mortgage debt is a nominal quantity, fixed in dollar terms until the borrower pays some of it down. So if periods of mild price falls are more common nowadays, households are more likely to end up in negative equity unless they do something about it by paying back principal. I'll have more to say about this in a moment. For now, just consider that higher debt burdens make it more likely that a household will run into repayment difficulty. And now that the transition period is over, low inflation makes it more likely that households in difficulty will be in negative equity. The meltdown in the US market cannot be explained by these factors alone, however. Mortgage arrears began rising rapidly well before unemployment did, and even when housing prices had fallen only modestly. You can see that in the graph here, where the blue line was clearly going up and many of the lenders were already going bust in 2007, and housing prices had really not moved that much at a national level. Had capacity to pay deteriorated so much? It is to this question I now want to turn. So what did go wrong in the United States? Well, much has been written on the causes of the crisis and the housing bust that sparked it, including by me. The causes are actually very complex, but I think they can be boiled down to three things. Lax lending practices. Lending standards eased in the United States far beyond what was seen in other countries over the boom period. Partly this was because certain specialist subprime lenders had gained market share, but individual lenders also lowered their standards during this period. Now, subprime lending has long been a niche in US mortgage finance. The traditional players in this market understood that it was a very risky customer base. These borrowers are, after all, people with a history of missing payments on other debt. During the boom in subprime mortgages, US lenders thought they could manage their exposure to these risky borrowers by ensuring that they would not remain customers for long. They tried to enforce this with loan terms that induced borrowers to refinance after a few years, like large scheduled increases in required repayments. But if credit wasn't available elsewhere, and the borrowers couldn't afford the higher subsequent repayments, default might have been their only option. Much of the subprime and other non-prime lending that went on was not based on proper assessments of the borrower's ability to service the loan. Brokers and lenders did not verify incomes or other financial obligations. All they seemed to care about was the value of the collateral. If housing prices kept rising, they assumed, the borrower could either refinance or sell, and everything would be fine. Oh, big assumption. We would never want to see this kind of asset-based lending in the Australian market. So subprime markets and lax lending decisions were key differences between the US and Australian markets. What happens during the life of the loan also matters a great deal. Some recent research by economists at the Federal Reserve suggests that it was not high proportions of subprime loans that predicted which districts in the United States would have worse outcomes for prices and loan defaults. Rather, it was the proportion of new lending that was on interest-only terms. These loans were not being paid down. In some cases, the loan balance was actually increasing through cash-out refinancing or explicit negative amortisation options. So how are Australia and the many other countries that are not in a US-style situation avoiding a US-style meltdown? As the banks made clear many times before, one important reason that Australia did not go down the same road as the United States is that lending standards didn't ease as much here. Even if at its peak, subprime lending was only ever a tiny fraction of the total, and it was done far more prudently. Low-doc loans were also a small niche. And we never saw the explosion of zero-deposit loans, or worse, the 125% loans that were available in the United Kingdom. In Australia in recent years, around two-thirds of new mortgage borrowers from banks had an initial loan-to-valuation ratio below 80%. If we look at the whole mortgage book, that fraction's even higher. Now, a large part of the reason why lending standards didn't ease as much here is that prudential supervision is stricter. Unlike in the United States, in Australia, most mortgage lending is done by firms that are prudentially regulated. And unlike in the United States, there is only one prudential supervisor, APRA. Australian lenders can't arbitrage differences in prudential treatment across different regulators, certainly happening in the United States during the boom. There are quite a few mortgage lenders that are not prudentially supervised, though. And this is where an important second line of defence comes in. Consumer protection standards around credit are a vital part of the authority's defence against a US-style situation, a part that, in my view, has been underappreciated to date. Consumer protection standards for credit products have in recent years been broadened and shifted to a national framework administered by ASIC. But the earlier state-based system still had the three features needed, most needed to avoid US-style outcomes. It was nationally consistent, it covered all consumer borrowers, and it covered all lenders consistently, regardless of whether they were prudentially supervised or not. This was not the case in the United States framework. Another very important mainstay against a US-style outcome is that many Australian households actually pay their mortgages down, often quite quickly. Estimates vary, but it seems that as many as half of owner-occupiers with mortgages pay it down faster than the contract requires. These are the green bars in this graph. The faster they pay it down, the less likely they are to end up in negative equity. They have a head start if prices should fall. Some of them must be running their debt down quite fast. Data from lenders, such as the orange bars in this graph, suggest the total amount of excess repayments made is similar to the amount of required repayments. This is a welcome feature of the Australian market that is rarely seen overseas. Now, the international regulatory community is all too aware of the role of lax lending practices in the US meltdown. In response, the Financial Stability Board, the FSB, has drafted some global principles for sound mortgage lending practices, which all countries should follow. These principles were released for consultation last year and should be finalised quite soon, perhaps in the coming weeks. Okay. I was part of the group that drafted the principles, so naturally I commend them to you. The principles recognise that lending standards are multidimensional. This is a crucial point. Many factors affect a borrower's capacity to repay their loan. Some of them are complementary and others can offset each other. The international debate about so-called macroprudential policy and financial stability policy more generally has been quite focused on housing and mortgages. For instance, there's been a lot of talk about the ideas of authorities setting a cap on loan-to-valuation ratios, LVRs, at origination, and periodically adjusting that cap. Some countries already do this. The FSB did not mandate or specifically encourage such a policy tool, though, and we do not think it is necessarily warranted in the Australian environment. It is, of course, important that borrowers put some of their own resources into the purchase of their home. But the focus should not be on maximum LVRs at origination, ignoring all other aspects of lending standards. In my view, capacity to pay, capacity to service the loan, is far more important. Looking at LVRs just at origination also ignores how these ratios evolve over the life of the loan and how they're distributed across households. In Australia, households in aggregate used to have very little debt against their homes relative to the value of those homes back when the financial sector was highly regulated and inflation eroded that debt quickly. And you can see that in the blue line in this chart. Obviously, this measure of leverage has risen since then. That's hardly a surprise. We should not expect to see it go back down to 10%. But neither would it be desirable for this ratio to approach where it was in the United States, let alone where it now is in the United States. However, we do not think that the most effective way to prevent that happening would be to impose a cap just for new borrowers. Nor do we think it's sensible to rely on simple rules like a ratio of loan income, loan amount to income. Nowadays, many Australian lenders sensibly take borrowers' other obligations and expenses into account when determining how much debt can be serviced and thus how much they'll lend. This wasn't happening in the United States. The principles themselves deal with the various dimensions of lending standards in their own order, but I like to group them into five dimensions. And first up is serviceability, or in simpler terms, capacity to pay. This is covered in Principle 2 of the FSB proposal. It's the crucial decision of how much to lend. And I think it's the decision point where it's all too easy to become complacent and lend too much. Lenders should also consider over what term the loan is to be serviced. The term affects how quickly the loan is paid down. As the principals also note, if the loan term extends past the normal retirement age, lenders need to allow for that when assessing capacity to pay. Don't assume, without good reason, that borrowers will necessarily downsize when they retire. Amortisation of the loan is also important. Principle 2.1 in the FSB document states, jurisdictions should ensure that lenders appropriately assess borrowers' ability to service and fully repay their loans without causing them undue hardship. The National Consumer Credit Code in Australia says something similar. Interest-only loans have their place, but the point about mortgage lending is that the household should be able to pay it off eventually. Otherwise, we would be in that undesirable world of asset-based lending. Of course, we do have to think about collateralisation or loan-to-valuation ratio. This is covered in Principle 3 of the proposal, where the FSB emphasised the need to avoid allowing higher LVRs just because housing prices happen to be rising. Principle 4 covers how that valuation should be arrived at. Finally, subordination greatly affects loan performance. Some of the worst loss outcomes in the US meltdown occurred in portfolios of second mortgages and the structured securities based upon them. Sometimes the lender for the first mortgage didn't even know that the second mortgage existed. Within each of these dimensions, both lenders and policymakers need to think about more than just the explicit loan terms. We must consider the variability of those terms and of the circumstances of the borrower. For example, does the borrower have an unusually volatile income or employment history? And have the borrower, both the borrower and the lender, allowed enough of a margin to cope with interest rate changes? We must also consider who has the option to vary those loan terms. Australian borrowers' tendency to repay ahead of schedule is a good example of this. And we must consider whether and how the lender can verify that the information they base their decisions upon is true. This last aspect is so important that the FSB made it the first of their principles. The problems with stated income loans and even outright fraud in the US market during its boom shows how important verification can be. In conclusion, I would like to stress that Australia, like many other countries, does not have the ingredients needed to create an outcome like that in the United States. But ensuring that remains the case, much will depend on you, the mortgage lenders. If I may use an analogy, we know perfectly well that the key to maintaining a healthy weight is to have a healthy diet and to exercise regularly. Yet we find it hard to avoid temptation. And so it is with maintaining a healthy mortgage market. It's always tempting to ease lending standards and dress that up as responding to competition or giving the customer a better deal. It must be hard to resist the disappointed customers who just want to borrow that bit extra to purchase their dream home, especially when the loan officer is also trying to make budget on new loan approvals. But in the experience of the United States, we've seen what happens when lenders yield to that temptation. If you as lenders were to ease lending standards beyond the point of prudence, you would not be doing anyone any favours. Your customers, the borrowers, would be overburdened by their debts. Your firms would face difficulties if loan defaults would arise. And financial stability would be much harder to maintain. Now, I'm pleased to say that I do not currently see any evidence of any signs of widespread lax lending practices here in Australia. And indeed, APRA has been consulting with the boards of the larger banking institutions about their housing lending standards. But there will be times, good times, when everything seems rosy, when lenders will find it hard to maintain the necessary prudence. And while the regulators can take actions and central bankers like me can warn of the risks, in the end, we all have a stake in maintaining financial stability. For financial stability is in the collective interest of all Australians. Thank you for your time.
Obviously, we're in a pretty good place when it comes to these lending standards. Mm. But there's quite a big gap, isn't there, between what we're doing in Australia and what you can see overseas. Mm. Is there an opportunity or is there a sort of capacity to relax the lending standards slightly in this country? Or, you know, are we too cautious, I suppose, is the question.
I wouldn't think of us as too cautious. I think we're now, what you've also got to remember, and as I said in the speech, we're now in a world where, you know, house prices are not going to be running ahead of income growth the way they did, you know, 10 years ago. And we have to get it into our heads that that's a permanent state of affairs. What we saw between sort of the mid-90s and the mid-2000s really was a transition to a new world, and we think we've kind of completed that transition. So more people are going to find that housing price growth is slower, income growth is now slower because inflation isn't boosting nominal wage growth in the same way. So the debt's not eroding to the same extent relative to incomes and capacity to pay as the loan goes on. Mm-hmm. And so you will see more, you know, it's basically you stay in the danger zone for longer. And so I don't think there's an enormous capacity for us to become less prudent. And even if I thought so, I'd probably never say it because that's just not what I'm here for. But
I did know that one after.
Yeah, but essentially, I think that this important point is that what we got away with during the late 90s and early 2000s is just not feasible now because we're just not in that world anymore.
Sure. And if I can ask one more question before I fly, do you get the impression then that other markets are looking at the Australian sort of regulatory environment and saying that's where we need to be?
Mm. I think it's fair to say that Australia isn't exactly Robinson Crusoe in terms of prudent mortgage lending standards. We're not unique. It was really the US that was sort of the furthest down the way of easing lending standards, the UK to a certain extent as well. But, you know, most you look at the mortgage markets around the world, and it was actually quite interesting being on this mortgage underwriting principles group because there were sort of mortgage experts from regulators and central banks and other authorities right around the world. And really, you know, most countries do not sort of stuff enormous mortgages down, you know, people's throats the way you were seeing in the US and sometimes in the UK, and to an extent here. I mean, there's certainly been times over the last 15 years or so where we've thought, oh, this is, you know, this probably won't be too bad because it's only a small part of the market, but, you know, that's what they said about subprime. And I think we have to remember it's never the average borrower who causes the trouble. It's the ones at the margins. And so it's the one who, you know, overextended themselves to get the dream home. It's the ones who overextend themselves to buy the second or the first or the second or the third investment property. You know, we really need to be alert to that. And I think we saw that in 02, 03. There were so many people getting into the investor property market who had not been in there before. I had a hairdresser who did that at the time. And, you know, that's always the danger sign when new people are getting into a market that perhaps they have less understanding of. They're the things you need to be really alert to, because they may not have a full appreciation of their own risks. And when all the incentives from the lender side are, you know, keep these loan approvals going through, we want to keep balance sheet growth going, well, that's exactly, you know, even with the best of intentions, you can have a situation that ends up quite toxic.
Michael, Qantas Staff Credit Union.
Lucy, if housing prices did get out of control in the future, do you think the Reserve Bank would again use interest rates to try to put downward pressure on prices?
I think the premise of your question is that we've used interest rates to make house prices fall in the past, and I think that's probably not really how I describe it. You know, obviously what goes on in housing markets and housing credit is an important part of the transmission mechanism of monetary policy, and we're also very alert to the fact that the state of household balance sheets tells you something about the risk profile of households and how well they're likely to be able to sustain and manage an economic shock. So obviously we look at these things, but interest rates are not used to target house prices per se. But certainly if housing prices were falling a long way, it wouldn't be happening in isolation. There would be other things going on in the economy as well, and no doubt those things would also be factoring into the board's decisions about the appropriate stance of monetary policy given what's happening with growth and inflation.
John Kavanagh from Banking Day. Are you able to say what the responsible lending rules in NCCP, what impact they've had on lending standards?
Data on this is, thanks, it's a good question, and unfortunately one of the things that I feel quite strongly is that we don't have good data on lending standards anywhere. Australia's not too bad. We've now got some of those, the thing I showed with the excess repayments, we've now got quite a good collection about, you know, LVRs at origination, a few other dimensions of lending standards. But one of the lessons of the crisis is there was never a framework for measuring lending standards. And part of it is there's no sort of internationally accepted statistical language for talking about lending standards the way there is for example, GDP or inflation. You know, we're sort of in the 1940s, you know, national accounts were kind of invented in 1940s, and we're kind of in that world when it comes to financial stability metrics. And so the dimensions of lending standards that I talked about is sort of, we've been kicking around some ideas trying to think about what an appropriate framework for analysing lending standards and going beyond, LVRs at origination. So it's kind of hard to pick it up statistically. I think it's certainly prevented further easing at a time when, you know, the economy's been doing reasonably well in many parts of the country, although, you know, as we know, there's, you know, variation within that. But, yeah, it's very hard to pick up a real change in lending practices as a consequence of that. But, you know, that's partly because, you know, we've had an improvement to our consumer credit protection standards around credit. But, you know, they weren't too bad beforehand. So you wouldn't expect, an enormous shift the way you'll be seeing now in the US with Dodd-Frank. I mean, there's been a big shift in sort of allowable mortgage lending standards, particularly if they're to be securitised. And I think that's going, you know, there has been a big tightening up in mortgage lending standards there, perhaps too far.
Victoria Short from Bankwest. I'm just interested in what you think positive or comprehensive reporting will do to the assessment of serviceability.
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. Australia is quite unusual in that it only has negative credit reporting at this point, and we don't have positive credit reporting. And it could go one of two ways. It could be really good because you know, we now have a lot more information about people's capacity to service their loans and the fact that they've managed to service their loans better, you know, quite well. And so, you know, that one missed, you know, credit card repayment because they were forgetful when they were 25 is not the only thing on their credit record anymore. There's all this, well, actually they had a mortgage that they paid down in 8 years and you wouldn't have known about it if you hadn't had that information. They're the sort of things that I think could certainly enhance assessments of people's capacity to pay. But we've also seen a situation, which is, I didn't mention in the speech, but one thing that happened in the US was that a lot of these lenders were really, they were delegating credit assessment to FICO. And the FICO scores were just taken as gospel. And what people forgot was that FICO scores are really about assessing people's capacity to maintain their credit card debt. So it's a very short-term focus. And it's an uncollateralized lending. And so that's a very different credit risk profile. And the same person could have quite different credit risk characteristics over mortgage lending. And I think what actually happened, I think that was one of the reasons why so many subprime and other non-prime lenders, you know, invented the 228s and the 327s, that it was all about keeping them as customers for 2 to 3 years so that the FICO score was broadly appropriate. But I think, you know, they delegated too much of the credit assessment to someone else. They didn't use the information that was available from them, from the borrower. They didn't use the soft information that they have from actually dealing with the customer. They didn't use all the payment history that they might have if they have the transaction account of that customer. And so, you know, it could go either way, and I sincerely hope that it will go the positive way, and that's something we'll certainly be alert to if we see signs of lenders just kind of using, I mean, automated models have their place. They're important to put some structure on people's thinking about credit risk. But once you start just kind of taking someone else's number as gospel, I think that would be a risky situation. And if that were to start happening here, I mean, we would be very alert to it.
Lucy, John Oliver from Homestart Finance in South Australia. You mentioned the that the level of LVR for first-home buyers or for new lending is much lower than 80%. There was an increased incidence of that. Does your data show to what degree the that borrowers are getting to that level by the increased use of family members guaranteeing loans to reduce the cost of LMI so that people can get into it, as opposed to I've genuinely saved more than 20% as a deposit? And do you have a view on the increased level of that type of lending?
Okay, just to clarify, the figures I cited about initial LVRs includes both first home buyers and other home buyers. So, I mean, the key distinction, I think, is that in Australia, trade-up buyers, so people who already have a home and are selling and buying again, they're the ones who've got low LVRs at origination. And that's actually unusual in the US. That was actually unusual in the US. So it's quite a distinction. In the US, during the boom, you know, even people who were on their second or third home, you know, they'd moved several times, you know, they still had no equity. They would still borrow up to the absolute maximum. They would burn all their equity. They would do cash out refinancing. So the fact that the LVR does decline over time quite quickly through sort of amortization and equity, I think that's, you know, that's really important. In terms of the first home buyers, the same survey that has the assessment of whether people repay their mortgages ahead of schedule does have some information about whether they got family help. It's a relatively small proportion, and I haven't got the figure in my head, but we know when they first bought the home and if they'd ever owned a home before and when they bought it, and then whether they got some help from families, but it's a bit partial. But it's not in the majority case. I think it's fair to say that, and you can see it in the figures, most first home buyers don't have a 20% down payment. Most repeat home buyers do, or at least a 20% down payment, and I think that's the distinction to make.